Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mother's Bathroom Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season 4. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. This episode is sponsored by AbbVie's GettingHereToThere.com, a safe online space for the Bipolar One community to find inspiration through music and firsthand stories. Visit GettingHereToThere.com to learn how advocacy musicians, music lovers, and others come together to reduce stigma and raise awareness of mental health. While you're there, sign up to be notified about additional support and resources. That's GettingHereToThere.com. Today, we are talking with Grammy Award-nominated singer-songwriter Mary Lambert. Mary has been a fantastic and outspoken advocate on issues such as mental health, LGBTQ rights, and body acceptance. And that activism has come through in Mary's music. Many of you know Mary from being featured on Macklemore's LGBTQ rights single Same Love, as well as her songs She Keeps Me Warm and Body Love. And her 2019 album Grief Creature addresses mental health issues of abuse, trauma, and depression. Mary just recently starred in the Netflix TV animated adventure musical film Arlo the Alligator Boy. So check out all of her work at MaryLambertSings.com. Now, on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so that we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And this week, Mary is talking about her struggle with bipolar disorder. Now, bipolar disorder is a mental illness that is particularly characterized by manic episodes in which an individual experiences a seeming elevation of mood that may make them feel more elated, energized, or grandiose, like they can take on the world. During manic episodes, people will often engage in very risky behavior, including unsafe sex, drug use, or even getting into fights. People who struggle with bipolar disorder may also experience episodes of depression, in which they will feel very differently than they do during a manic episode. They have no energy, feel worthless, and unable to do even basic tasks. And these episodes may often feel like they come out of nowhere, where people struggling with bipolar feel trapped by a biological process over which they have no control. Now, one of the difficulties that many people describe when they struggle with bipolar disorder is how to interpret their manic episode. On the one hand, people feel energized and productive and seemingly positive. This can be a welcome relief from feeling worthless while depressed. But what Mary explains during our conversation is that when she's experiencing a manic episode, she does feel energized, but her mood is flat. She's not actually feeling so great about herself. And so that's why Mary described her manic episodes as the time when she feels most at risk for suicide, that dangerous combination of feeling really edgy and impulsive, but not feeling good about herself per se. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. On the Consequence website and wherever you find these episodes, you'll also find a short questionnaire. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. We incorporate these responses into episodes, as well as a monthly column called Ask Dr. Mike on the Consequence website. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so they can go there with us. So let's go there and hear what Mary has to say.
You ready to get started?
Let's go.
Let's go. Okay, Mary, welcome to Going There.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. I'm so excited to go there.
Yes, we're going to go there. And so let's just go there. You know, one of the things that you and I talked about ahead of time is the very difficult issue of bipolar disorder. And so let's just, you've been very outspoken about having struggled with it, which is very, very much appreciated to anyone who's been struggling with or who's a mental health advocate. And so I just want to start with, what has bipolar been to you? How does it manifest for you in terms of how you feel and what you go through?
Yeah, I was diagnosed when I was like 12 or 13, but I thought I was like, no, I do theater. Like I'm just incredibly dramatic. So I didn't really believe my diagnosis. I felt like I had been reading a lot of, I'd been reading a lot of literature on mental illness and trauma at the time. I thought I wanted to be a therapist when I was 9. So I read like case studies of adolescents who had experienced trauma. I read Reviving Ophelia. And I thought I had sort of self-diagnosed that I just had PTSD, that I was like, no, I just had a really, really abusive childhood. And my brain is just coping, and I just sometimes want to die. And other times I am bouncing off the walls and cannot be contained. And everything makes me cry and everything makes me laugh for an hour. So when I was diagnosed, I kind of waved it off. And then when I was about 17, things got pretty, pretty bad. Like a climax of awful things happening all at once. I was in the evangelical church and had realized I was gay. And I had lost my bandmate and like one of my best friends to leukemia. And I was trigger warning sexual assault. I was gang raped in an army barracks, and I felt really, really lost. So I attempted suicide when I was 17, and luckily, I was okay. And I think that was when I realized that day that I attempted suicide, the day before, I had one of the best days of my whole life. I was like, it was like just really strong feelings of euphoria. And I stayed up the whole night. I was just so, I didn't know it at the time. I was just like really, really manic. And the next day I woke up and I was just like, oh, I'm ready for this to end. Like, this is, I'm done here. So after that, I went on a couple different medications. The feeling sort of persisted of suicidality. And so I got put on Seroquel, like a really high dosage of Seroquel to sort of calm me down. But I hated that. I was like falling asleep in class and then getting in trouble for falling asleep in class. And I always like prided myself on being a good student. And then I was given Lamotrigine. And because I hated the Seroquel so much, I stopped taking everything all together at some point. And then went off the rails again. And I sort of did that back and forth until my early 20s. And I was, I was with a girl who, you know, was worried about me and was like, it seems like you go through pretty intense cycles. And I was like, well, I'm diagnosed bipolar. And she was like, what? Like you're not doing anything about it? I was like, okay, maybe I should try medication again. So I've been on Lamotrigine since then. So I've been on it for about 10, 12 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously I'm sorry that all of those things happened to you that sound, you know, horrible and traumatic. And to the extent that you feel comfortable talking about them, I want to, you know, kind of talk about that in terms of how it's influenced your mental health. If I could just, just so that people understand what the highs and the lows feel like.
Yeah.
If for you and what you're talking about, it sounds like is a more rapid cycle. Mm-hmm. And so what do those highs feel like for you? You kind of described it as euphoric.
Yeah. So for, you know, everybody's bipolar disorder is different. For me, I rapid cycle, and I also have what I think they're calling it mixed features now, like instead of like mixed episodes. So my partner is also bipolar, and we've sort of, it's been an incredible, like incredibly amazing thing to be able to just talk to somebody who knows. But there is this feeling when you are euphoric, where it's not like everything's so amazing that, you know, you, it's not like extreme feelings of elation. It is like, sometimes it is the worst part of bipolar disorder. I may be getting a lot of stuff done, but I am, it might not be the right stuff. I may be really, really, I'm trying to think of, it's so difficult to make mental illness legible when it's in your brain. So how do you communicate through it? It's been a real challenge, most of my life, but, it's like, I definitely have like feelings of grandeur. Like I'm so on top of the world and I can do and achieve anything. Like I could go to the moon if I wanted to. I'm so in the moment where it's like, I used to do really, really impulsively reckless things before I was medicated. But just like that, nothing could touch me. Like I was invincible. Like I would do really reckless things because I knew I was gonna like this is it. This is now. YOLO. It just feels like you could do anything. Like all the power, you have all the power. And I'm trying to think, and there's absolutely like joy with it, you know. And I think that's what is frustrating sometimes about bipolar disorder, is like, when do you trust your happiness, and when do you trust like when do you trust depression or like just like a sad day, and know that it's not chemical. So as I've gotten older, I feel like I can start to distinct like what's real and what's not. But as of course, like in your early 20s or when you're first, you know, when you're first diagnosed for anybody, it feels like, my God, it feels like a mountain of things I have to learn that I have just assumed everything was, you know, normal. Yeah.
And what you're talking about with that euphoria, often people describe as there's this pressure, you know, like it's almost like I think a lot, I know this may be kind of an unusual analogy, but I think of the comic book character Cyclops with like the stuff coming out of his eyes that's totally uncontrollable. And on the one hand, there's this tremendous power, but on the other hand, it's just coming out, like if it's not controlled somehow. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, when they describe bipolar disorder, they describe the manic episodes as, yes, there's this invincibility, there's this this power, but it's so pressured and so much like you feel as though, am I the one who's driving this car, or am I just mm-hmm. kind of in the passenger seat at that mm-hmm. point?
Totally. Yeah. I also think, like, I'm really, really fortunate to be able to have like an outlet to process stuff and to like work through things. And also to have sort of something tangible to work through those feelings. But that's, you know, the times that I have done harmful things to myself have been when I'm euphoric, have been when I'm manic. It is like I feel like a prisoner in my own brain that I am. I tried to explain it to an ex one time that I felt like Bellatrix Lestrange in jail, where she's like, she's pulling at the bars and she's screaming and she's like, you know, I want to do all of this insane stuff and I don't know where it's coming from. And the times when I've been, you know, I experienced a really difficult episode 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And I experienced psychosis. So I just started hallucinating and became very delusional. And, you know, when you are a highly functioning bipolar person, you're not supposed to have those episodes. And so I didn't want to check myself in or anything like that, because I was like in the middle of making an album and was like, I need to produce. I'll just put this into my art. And I survived. I didn't do anything incredibly reckless, but the mental state I was in. And I think during the course of that time, I maybe slept, I mean, maybe 10 hours through each week at a time. It was like, I was just constantly up. And I think that was probably part of the, you know, hallucinations and delusions, is that I couldn't sleep. Yeah.
One of the things that's so difficult, and you mentioned that concept of trusting yourself, is that, you know, look, I'm making the assumption based on your success that you are a driven person. You don't get to your level of success without being a driven person. And so there's also, as a creative person, there's a feeling of, look, there's stuff coming out of me that is my music and my art and my creativity and my passions and all that. And I'm in the studio and I want to get there, and it's, you know, and I'm just working and I'm working and I'm pushing myself. And it's so hard to know, where's the line? Number one, what's the origin of it? Mm-hmm. To trust yourself? Like, is this a healthy origin? Mm-hmm. And at what point, even if it starts healthy, does it morph? Because yeah. up until the very extreme moment, it all kind of looks similar, unfortunately.
Right. That's so true. I mean, because the parallels between like a tortured artist, like the ways that we view artists already, that being sort of erratic and, you know, compulsive and, you know, especially for like prolific artists, like, you know, I just saw the Mountain Goats and I was just thinking about, like, you know, like they make like an album a year, you know, and what that kind of takes. And not everybody who's an artist is mentally ill, and not all mentally ill people are artists. And it is such a difficult line to know, like, am I doing this for the sake of, you know, the project in with an undercurrent of stability, or does this come at a cost to my mental health? Am I making sacrifices to produce, to like be a productive person and achieve this, you know, this level of success that is important to me, that I'm determined to do? What, you know, what limbs am I cutting off in order to do that?
Which is obviously a very odd sort of question, considering that the semi-stated purpose of any high-powered profession is, what limbs are you willing to cut off mm. in order to do this? Mm. You know, are you willing, you know, as people who I'll work with in finance, it's like, well, are you willing to work 100 hours a week and mm-hmm. and get 5 hours of sleep? Are you mm-hmm. willing to, you know, right. be called at any moment, you know, in right. order to do whatever it is that needs doing? And in music, in order to be successful, I mean, you think about the trajectory of, you know, well, are you willing to tour at a very intense, I mean, by definition, almost how much you're willing to do is one of the things, not just yeah. talent, that sets you a person who's a professional
right.
from an amateur. And so that idea of, again, knowing how to modulate that alone, but then when throwing in, but I also don't know whether this is mental illness, is just, it's like, how do you even navigate something like
that? Totally. Yeah. I think for me, there's a really clear distinction of because my work, I feel like there's a duality in it that like the initial writing process is so incredibly cathartic. And part of the reason I'm alive, I think the main reason I'm alive, that like songwriting is a form of survival and catharsis, and it's an insular process. And so for me, I feel like I'm able to like when I songwrite, like if I'm just sitting at the piano, I will sit at the piano for hours. And I feel like it's this divine connection to God. Like I feel like I am connected to something really, really deep. And when I write, I'm able to say, you know, what would I communicate to the world if I could? I've written like 100 songs that I'll never release because they're just like, they're for me. They were for like a process, a thing to process. So then there's the sharing, you know, like what do I decide to share? And for me, like the utility is important. I want to know that what I'm doing is like, I guess I feel a sort of like civic obligation. Like I really want to nurture and be good and be like a steward of goodness for everyone and to make this world better. And so when I release music, that's sort of the intention when I share it. What gets sort of complicated, and I think how bipolar disorder really affects that process, is in sort of the sharing, is in like the marketing and like the whole, that's where the industry comes in, right? Like when I was signed to Capitol Records, and my project team was Katy Perry's project team. So they only worked on Katy and me. And I don't know, I have no idea how she does it, how she did it, how she survives doing that. It was so grueling and was one of like the darkest times in my life. And there's that fear of, well, anyone would kill to have this opportunity. And now I have 100 people working one song, like pushing one song out there. I don't want to let anybody down. So I'm going to like just quiet everything so I can just get this job done. And you can do that, but it comes at a cost to something and it's not sustainable. So your needs don't ever like, your needs don't disappear. They don't go away. You just displace them. And then they tend to blow up in your face if you don't take care of it. And so I've really experienced the pain and that frustration of not being able to conform to a sort of like, I mean, I guess it's capitalism, right? Like I like being able to fit into this, this job that so many people seem to do so well at that I couldn't do. And, yeah. And that was just sort of evident at a certain point with the label where I was like, I'm bipolar. Like, I don't think that I can do what you guys are used to. And, I needed help. So it was a mutually beneficial parting.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to actually get into that concept because you talked about spreading goodness, and I want to touch back on that and what goes into having this career. But before we do, I just wanted to also talk about the depressive side of, you know, because what we were talking about before is the sort of manic side. And one of the things that's so particularly difficult about bipolar You know, a lot of people, when they have something, I mean, obviously, like, having depression is horrible in many ways. It's one of the things that is unfortunately horrible about it, but there's a certain, at times, predictability, is that it's depression or it's not depression. Mm. You know, but it's the swings. Mm-hmm. I think it adds another nuance of challenge, whereby, you know, again, you're talking about the stress on your system. And so could we talk about going from that high to a low and what that feels like?
Right. So I think what I experience, I don't know if it's like what other bipolar people experience, but like when I'm in a sort of euphoric state, that's the time when I've like those are the times where I've attempted suicide. Like
that level. And I'm kind of curious what feels different in terms of is it that what's happening when you're manic is that you're like, I can do anything, and it kind of goes in that direction? Or is it just that things are so bad? And then if that's the case, what's different about the depression where it doesn't get to that point where something like suicidality is not something that's on your mind?
Right. Yeah. I think with mania, it's this, I mean, that's why I think my bipolar is different than most people's, because of those sort of mixed features, where it's like my brain is working so, so fast. I like developed this system, like this scale of how I could explain what was happening to me. So I have like this, it's like a scale from 1 to 10 of like how quickly is my brain moving? Like how fast are my thoughts coming? What is the, like, what's the sort of energy of it? And then from a scale, in a separate scale from 1 to 10, what is my mood like, from like really, really depressed to really, really happy? And what I notice is that when I am, like, most often when I'm manic, if there's any sort of underlying thing going on in my life, the energy, the thoughts move really, really quickly, and my mood is like down to zero. So like it's a really dangerous combination to like have your brain be moving so quickly and to have like impulsivity and feel incredibly depressed. So depression for me, like the typical swings people talk about, for me, it just doesn't, I'm too like tired to like do anything about how sad I am. and so there is this sense in depression where I'm like, I don't care to do anything about it. I just feel it, just a real lack of motivation.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you're talking about that's so interesting, and I think difficult maybe for people who don't struggle with it to understand, is that when you're in that manic phase, your energy is at maximum, but your mood is down, and how dangerous of a combination that is, as opposed to depression where your mood is down, but you know, a lot of the people that I work with will say, I don't have the energy to do anything at all, exactly. Let alone like something that's self-harm. Yeah. And so that's something when people see someone who's in a manic state, it's like, that's not necessarily happy.
Right.
That's energized.
Yes, exactly. Totally. I mean, I feel like it's been the most difficult part of bipolar disorder isn't sort of those depressive episodes. It's like managing when mania starts to hit, that like, okay, what do I have all of my, you know, mechanisms in place to protect me from, like, the storm is coming. And how can I safely channel, you know, what are the benefits? How can I safely channel all of this in a way that's not destructive? And so I tend to really, really obsess over things. And so I will find something safe to obsess over, whether it's like a cell phone game or a TV show or something where I can direct that sort of obsessive thinking. That's been helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, One of the things that I did want to just offer up to talk about, and again, I appreciate that you said trigger warning, but when you talked about the assault, which is obviously, you know, incredibly traumatic event, do you feel comfortable talking about that in the context of how that influences your mood?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, for me, sexual trauma has been such a unfortunately, like a prevalent thing in my life. So I was sexually abused by my dad growing up. And I think when you're sexualized so early on, you become just sort of a sexual kid. Like, you have all of these, like all of this knowledge you really shouldn't have yet. And so for me, that ended up turning into, like, you know, I was just obsessed with being loved, like having somebody like want me. And so I'm not victim blaming myself, but I did put myself in a lot of risky situations and dangerous situations, and that sort of, like, you know, amplified by, you know, heavily drinking and substances and things like that, like, was just a bad combination. But yeah, that particular assault was really, it was super traumatic. But I think what happens with a lot of trauma is, like, you have to create a narrative for it to make it make sense. And at the time, my, you know, perspective of what rape was like, you know, a guy with a gun to your head, you know, like I thought, well, I eventually, you know, acquiesced, like I eventually, like, accepted what was happening. So that acceptance must have meant that I, like, allowed it to happen or whatever. And so it took me a while to see, like, what had happened as, you know, an act of violence. I felt like, no, I woke up the next morning and I cheated on my boyfriend, you know, like that's what I did. I did something really, really awful, and it's my fault. Without being like, oh, I said a no and I didn't want to, you know? And that in regards to, I mean, that sort of put me into a total tailspin. I think shame is, like, at the core of so much of that. And I think it really was, it sat really nicely in bipolar disorder, because I was able to, just, like, the shame cycle just got louder and worse.
And I think that what can happen is that the shame from a traumatic event, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily understand that when you struggle with a mental health issue, especially if you don't know what it is, there can be shame from that as well, where it's sort of like, I'm ashamed that I can't control myself, that I'm not similar to what I'm seeing with other people.
Yeah.
And what you're describing is this almost perfect storm of shame.
Right.
And that I can imagine just how overwhelming that must have been to feel like all of these things are coming together around that idea.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of bipolar people experience this, but there's this, like, once you have reached homeostasis again, and you're, like, you know, at a calm place post mania or post depression, you have to go on this sort of, like, apology tour of, like, I'm really, really sorry for all the things I did. And it's a really difficult balance to be like, that wasn't me, but also I want to take accountability, and that's not acceptable, but also it wasn't me. like, I swear I'm not like that. You know, it feels, and then again, then you have, like, that whole shame cycle where it's like you just end up spiraling, and then you feel like shit, because you have to apologize for who you are and what your brain does, and it feels never ending.
And you know what's so interesting but unfortunate about that is, like, we never apologize to ourselves for the shame we inflict. And it's like, you're right. Like everybody gets the apology tour. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets considered, you know, mm-hmm. you're talking about in that case, your boyfriend or whoever, when you were manic or depressed or whatever it is. And we never, ever, ever get around to being like, hey, you know, I kind of knew that you had suffered something traumatic and I blamed you anyway. Sorry mm-hmm. about that, you know, yeah. to ourselves. And so we're the only ones left.
Right.
And no one apologizes to right. us.
Right.
And it's just like, you know, what do you do with that? You think you're being so responsible and whatever. And then it just builds up. It's like you said that, like shame. It's, I don't even know at that point, if it becomes a spiral, it just becomes like a tsunami.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is, I mean, that's like the crux of mental disorders too, is like, it doesn't really ever get, it sounds so nihilistic. It doesn't ever really get better, but your strategies and your like ability to cope and your like awareness of what may happen or what has historically happened gets better, so that you can sort of like, you know, anticipate or be aware of those triggers. And the ability to communicate through it is really important, because I think that's what's so, it's not just the behaviors that are, you know, affected through mental illness. It's also like, how do I communicate this in a way that, first of all, doesn't freak people out? I mean, I remember trying to explain this to my ex, and like, just, it freaked her out. She's like, I am not comfortable with the fact that there is a point in your day where you have suicidal ideation. Like, that freaks me out, and I'm not comfortable with that. I'm like, I don't know how to tell you that at this point in my relationship with bipolar disorder, I know to not trust it. I know that it's a trick. I know that, like, I just need to wait it out and breathe through it and find all my, like, get all my coping strategies like going, and then I'm going to work through it. I don't know how to tell you that I can't control that, but I at this point, I know what it means, and I know that it's not really happening.
Hi there. This is Jill Hopkins from The Opus. After you check out this latest episode of my show, be sure to check out some of the other great programs on Consequence Podcast Network, including Rootsland, an original story of two friends who take a musical and spiritual journey from the suburbs of Long Island to the streets of Kingston, Jamaica. Or Standing BTS, a biweekly podcast covering all things BTS and ARMY. Oh, and then there's The What Podcast. It's a weekly podcast by two Bonnaroo veterans exploring and highlighting the live music scene. They're all fantastic. So head to consequence.net to listen to these podcasts and many great others.
The thing that's such a shame, if you will, is that, and I think that's why it's so important when people like yourself step up and talk about these issues, is that we do know how to do that with everything else. We know how to do that with asthma. We know how to do that with headaches. We know how to do it with cancer. We know how to do it with diabetes.
Totally.
Every single thing, you know, oh, like, you know, I don't want to hear that you're having heart palpitations. Like, you know, that's freaking me out. It's like, well, what do you want me to do? I have heart disease. You know, it's like, and nobody, I mean, I shouldn't say that nobody says that. Like, obviously it's very disconcerting, but it comes from a place oftentimes where people are like, I'm so concerned about you. And, you know, there's all this empathy and sympathy and care that gets delivered. Mm-hmm. And we just don't do that with mental health issues, right. even though it's just as biologically based.
Right.
You know, all these things are, it's biology and stress. You right. know what I mean?
Right.
Like, in a lot of ways. And it's sort of like, and I think people are starting to get it, but we're very far from there being parity. Yeah. In terms of other physical health conditions.
I agree. And I think also, if you subscribe to that same sort of belief system, then you're not going to advocate for yourself. So you have to get on board with it because you're going to be the only person that's going to fight for your, like, your validity, you know? And like, you can read as many like posts on Instagram that tell you that your mental illness is valid, but it's like, unless you really truly embody it and believe it and advocate for yourself, you're like, you're screwed. And it's not, it shouldn't be that way, but like, unfortunately, like that's sort of the reality of it, you know?
I agree with you 1,000%. It's like, as much as it's horrible, it's like, yeah, to understand yourself, to be empathic with yourself. And unfortunately, the burden of having to educate the people around you. And that adds this, like, I mean, it adds this whole other stress to it. You still, unfortunately, we still have to do it.
Up in my, you know, daily life is I'm very forgetful. I'm incredibly absent-minded. I'll forget conversations or like, most often it's like things. I forget where I put my keys. I forget where I put my phone. And when I was in college, it got incredibly bad. And the most common thing was that I locked my keys in the car. And that was, I did it constantly. And so I used up all of the AAA calls to get the car keys out. And then I just had this feeling. I was like, I have to get better at this. I have to change. And I thought that, I don't know, I guess I thought like the solution was to like keep punishing myself and keep saying like, no, you need to conform. The rest of the world doesn't do this. What's wrong with you? So instead of like creating a compassionate, you know, dialogue with myself, I opened a credit card specifically to have the locksmith come out and open my car, and I maxed it out within like 2 months. So it was like, it happened honestly like 4 or 5 times a month, enough to where it became like a financial burden. And something just like snapped where I was like, I'm creating a hell. I'm making myself miserable. I got to be like super in debt, and it was like, how the hell am I going to like crawl out of this? And I realized that I was like, yeah, creating these conditions that were so, so lacking in compassion and empathy for myself that I thought, you know, like, okay, this hasn't worked. Let me try something else. So I made 4 copies of the car key and I gave one to my roommate. I put a second one in my bag. I hid one at school. I don't remember where I put it. It's probably still there somewhere. And when I locked my keys in my car, you know, I that's what I thought. I was like, if I lock my keys in my car, I'm gonna have a second key. I swear to God, to this day, after I made those keys, I never locked my keys in the car again. I didn't need them. I ended up not needing them. It was like this act of like radical compassion for myself unlocked, pardon the pun, like this part of my brain that was like, oh, okay, well, we won't do this anymore. Like, here's this compassion you offered. And now we offer you the ability to remember. It's like a lesson.
Yeah, no. And the thing that you're talking about, and that's why I love that quote that you have where we won't take shame for an answer. You know, that it's when we get into that shame cycle, it is like there's no conversation happening with ourselves. We're yelling at ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're like, you know, we're beating ourselves emotionally, sometimes physically, you know, where we just want it to stop. And just like with every study on thought suppression, on emotional suppression, on experiential avoidance, it just comes back worse. And being able to stop with that and start with, look, this is happening. Mm-hmm. I'm not, and accepting doesn't mean like I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. It just means that I'm acknowledging that it's happening.
Right.
And just because this is happening doesn't mean that I'm no longer deserving of compassion or empathy because there's something that's different about me. Right. And this is why, like, you know, you and I talked ahead of time that we're not even getting into all the issues of that are the other issues that you take on in terms of discrimination, in terms of people who struggle with weight or in the LGBTQ community. And like, just, it seems as though in general, we have this tendency, if there's something different, the first thing is different, weird, shame, stop it. Mm-hmm. You know, and then after that, it's like, oh, well, if you can crawl out of that, it's like, I guess we'll sort of let you back in right. to whatever quote unquote society is.
Right.
And it's such a horrible tendency. Instead of looking at something as different, oh, you know, I experience mood this way. You experience mood that way. Mm-hmm. We both are looking to work, to love, to mm-hmm. enjoy. It's like, so this is what I need. What do you need?
Right.
And it's just, we're just not there yet, but I feel totally. Like we're getting more there. And that's totally. Why, you know, when you're saying like, let's not stop at shame for the answer. Or like, you know, you said things like vulnerability is the key to empathy, or, you know, you need to express darkness as the key to happiness. Like, I think those are all in the right direction, because if you can stop by saying like, listen, shame's not what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. You can be vulnerable and you can express your darkness. And that's a way to, again, it's not going to go away, mm-hmm. but there's a path, you know, there's mm-hmm. a path to the, your life feeling better. Mm-hmm. That to me is like everything about where we need to go at this
totally.
Point.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely noticed this in sort of, in the work that I do with weight stigma and fat people too, is like, there is this feeling that if you are not thin, you are just constantly failing. And just like, not only is your own sort of self-perception as failing, but you it's reinforced everywhere. And so the sort of first foundational step of like, living an uninhibited, like joyful life is that acceptance, is being like, this is where I am at. This is who I am. Like, I need to get to at least a place that's neutral so that I can begin to sort of heal, so that I can sort of examine what, like separating, Judith Matz talks about this. She's like one of the like first anti-diet like pioneers. She always makes a distinction of like, we have to separate characteristics like being fat or like being, you know, like having bipolar disorder from behavior, that like these things aren't like fatness isn't a behavior, right? It's just like height. It's just a characteristic. And so like, if we can examine behavior, which is more tricky to do, and it like requires like, you know, a reliable narrator, someone that's not obsessed with people pleasing, then you can sort of start to heal or create behaviors that are more helpful.
Yeah. And, but the, you know, the, and I agree, I should say, but like, and the thing is that you don't, so many people think to themselves, well, I'll be deserving of not being ashamed of myself. I'll be deserving of compassion. I'll be deserving of empathy. I'll be deserving of being allowed back at the table when I change this thing about myself.
That's so true. And
just to say like, no, like you deserve the empathy, you deserve the compassion, you deserve to be on the table, period.
Yeah.
Now the question is like, everybody wants to live their life to whatever their vision is of the highest functioning. Now let's manage whatever we think is interfering with that from that perspective, but not from that gatekeeper perspective where it's like, hey, you know, and it's so tempting because it's like, we all kind of collude with it. I'm going to go away. I'm going to work on myself and then I'm going to come back. And look, there are some situations where I guess if you feel like you're doing all this damage in the world, like you said, like, you know, I kind of, you know, sometimes, you know, taking a breath and pulling back is an answer of sorts, but that's different than being like, I don't deserve to be part of society, you know? And that is, I think for a lot of people, how it feels to have a really like, I mean, we're talking here about, you know, mental health issues. I think that a lot of times anything that's different feels like, all right, well, I got to see what I can do about that. So I can join the club. which is ironic because nobody wants to be a part of a club where you're not allowed to be different. So it's this very odd thing that we do because nobody wants to be in a world where our weaknesses are the focus of shame and the thing that separates us. Yet we all kind of collude with it. And we all like kind of contribute to that when it's not us.
Right. I think that's like the central part of feeling better and healing is the ability to reframe and to say like, what, like I'm at a point where like, when I meet somebody that doesn't have mental illness, I'm like, how do you handle the world? Like the world is nuts. The world is like insane. Like the amount of stimulation and distraction and like, you know, pressure and advertise, like, how do you deal with that and not have your brain create a shortcut for you to like be in the world, like to be in reality. And now I feel like I'm able to see it as sort of like, oh, my brain is protecting me so that I can function. Like my body did the same thing. My body is protecting me so that I can function. And if you can reframe it and see it as like, oh, this is a gift. Like this is like the beautiful mechanism of survival that we get to like understand a deeper part of ourselves. And if we allow that to be, you know, a central like tenet of our existence, then we can find like community. Then you can find other people that are experiencing the same thing as you. And I think that that's the power of empathy is like, you remember those really painful, shameful, dark times. You wouldn't wish that on anyone. So like you have this ability to say like, hey, this thing is happening to me. Anybody else? And it's like the minute you see yourself reflected in either a conversation or on screen or like in a book or a movie, it's like this huge weight is lifted. It's like, oh my God, I'm not a freak, you know?
Yeah. Cause you just need to know, you know, and that's why it's hard also. And I find it in the health profession, just sort of in the mental health profession, you can't fake that. Mm. You know, you have to either be like, I get it, or you have to at least be honest that you don't get it.
Right.
You know what I mean? But there has to be that something is like, look, we're human beings having this conversation again. Like you have that conversation with yourself, you have it with someone else. And I agree with you, but when you can find, and that's why people, you know, how many people will say music saved me because that was the first time I heard anyone talking about depression. That was the first time ever someone talking about loving someone who was same sex. That was the first time I ever heard about, you know, someone talking about, you know, just anything. And, and once you have that, just knowing that there's one person out there, you know, who has anything like you, which is why I think, you know, people like yourself stepping up who have so many fans, just knowing like, oh, you know, Mary's talking about it. Maybe there's hope for me like, you know, is the beginning of, again, shifting from that shame to that understanding and empathy. And it would be very different for people.
Right. I think so too. I always think of that, you know, like the galaxy brain meme where like the, you know, the first brain is like, I don't need to talk to anybody. I need to figure this out on myself. And then the next brain is like, ah, maybe I should talk to somebody or get help. And it's okay the way I am. And then the whole galaxy brain is like, if everybody is struggling in some way and everybody needs therapy and everybody is challenged in all these ways, maybe the systems are a part of this. Like maybe the culture that we have created, maybe what we're experiencing is part of a greater flaw in the system. And I am not broken and you are not broken. And we are all just surviving in the system that needs to be like totally taken apart and reexamined and see how it can be more inclusive for everybody.
Just maybe. I think that has to be the final word. That was too powerful to follow up. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. It's been great talking with you. I'm sorry just that you know, it's a lot that you've been through, but I really appreciate you sharing it because it really, I think, is going to help people change that shame cycle and that shame spiral.
Thank you. I could just talk all day about this stuff.
Well, can we will plan on another time for sure.
Yeah, I would love to. Part two.
Part two. I love it.
So there it is. Mary Lambert talking about her experience struggling with bipolar disorder. There is so much to take away from the conversation with Mary. One of the things that I wanted to highlight was a phrase Mary used at the beginning of our discussion, that she is trying to make mental health legible. I really appreciated Mary using this term and her work over the years to help us all make our mental health a bit more legible. Mary talks about many issues that impacted her mental health. Not only does she struggle with bipolar disorder, but also she struggled with trauma and discrimination based on her sexual orientation and weight. When we talk about mental health, we often talk about single diagnoses, like when I said at the beginning of the episode that we are talking about bipolar disorder only. But the truth is that at any one time, there are many feelings, thoughts, and behaviors that we may have that may come from different parts of our lives and experiences. We don't always know what we are feeling, thinking, or doing, or why these experiences happen. That's why it's so important that we be curious about, rather than critical of, our experience. We need to focus on making our mental health more legible, more clear and understandable, rather than shaming and judging ourselves. That way, rather than hide from or avoid our mental health and well-being, we can examine our experience so that we can help ourselves cope and heal. I want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and Sound Mind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to our sponsor, AbbVie's GettingHereToThere.com, a safe online space for the Borderline One community to find inspiration through music and firsthand stories. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with bipolar disorder, trauma, anxiety, depression, or addiction, and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. If you're thinking about harming yourself and want to seek help, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You may also go to the Sound Mind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the crossroads.